thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank James and Pip and Dave and the events team here at DHOXSS or DHOXSS or DH Oxford Summer School. It really is a pleasure for me to be here for a number of reasons. First of all, I have known, as James said, we've known one another for a long time, and I think he's super cool. And I've always wanted to meet Pip Wilcox, and I finally have gotten to do it here today. So the dirty secret, I think, among those of us who do these institutes is everybody wants to come to Oxford. And not just because it's Oxford, but because James and Pip are here. So I've been trying for years to figure out how I could come, and now they've allowed me to be here, so I'm very grateful for that. I'm also really happy to be here the morning of your first day. I expect you're going to have a really challenging, I know you're going to have a challenging and exciting and sometimes exhausting week, because I've been through enough of these that I know what's going on. I would like to apologize in advance. I picked up what's become known internationally as the DHSI plague. I got it when I was in Victoria. It's a blur, but I think it was 2 weeks ago. And it struck again last night. So if I sound like I'm underwater, in my head, I'm underwater. So please forgive me. And if this goes really slow or really quickly, it's because I'm doing my best to stay conscious and focused. Okay. So how many of you, raise your hands, have been to a DH training institute before? Okay, good. For those of you who have, you'll know that it's a vigorous several days, as I said. Today, everything is going to be a bit new and strange, even if you've been to one of these before. By the third day, may feel like you're never going to be able to get to the end. You'll be so frustrated that you'll be banging your head against your keyboard and wondering why your code won't validate if you're doing a TEI course. And then on the last morning, you'll never want to leave. You'll wish this could keep going, and you'll be all best friends, and it'll be a wonderful thing. And that happens every time. It's very strange. I started going to DHSI as a grad student in 2006. I've been teaching the pedagogy course there since 2011. Since then, I've been farmed out to other DH institutes as well. So every time and with every group, even though each institute is unique in its own way and has all sorts of discrete and special properties, these types of feelings seem to translate time and again. Excuse me. So with that, I hope you have a wonderful week. I feel your enthusiasm. I anticipate your anxiety. And I look forward to hoping to see on the Twitters, because I won't be here on Friday, how you make it through. If you'll humor me, I'm going to try and juggle between my notes and the slides, so please be patient. I'd like to ask you to help me work through some things that they've been eating away at me at the back of my brain for a while now, and I haven't been able to quite figure out why. And so it's a work in progress, and it's a thought in progress. And it's become important to me as I've become involved with more projects and more discussions about projects and paying attention to more themes that are burbling up through the digital humanities, especially in terms of large funded projects that have many fast-moving pieces. And I think this is perhaps a very interesting vantage point to help shape the questions I have because of the nature of this institute and the ways in which you're coming to it. So perhaps you can help me in conversation afterwards. And perhaps what I present to you can help you to prompt ways in which you're thinking about what you're doing this week and how it may relate to things that your colleagues are doing or things you're interested in thinking about going forward. All right, let me see if I can make this piece work, all the moving pieces. Charles Lucas, in his 1741 Pharmacomastics, despairs of the expectations of English apothecaries in a way that rings true for many of us in DH. The very druggist, who in all other nations in Europe is but pharmacopola, a mere drug merchant, is with us not only a physician and a chirurgeon, but also a Galenic and chemic apothecary, a seller of drugs, medicines, vernices, oils, paints or colors, poisons, etc., a jack of all trades, and in truth, master of none. That phrase, awkward as it is in terms of its gendering of labor, should actually demonstrate one's value, serve as a compliment or recognition of one's dexterity. And yet, while the OED defines this Jack as a man who can turn his hand to many things, the idea of one who can do many things is often paired with the conclusion that they cannot possibly succeed at any. That's how I feel, much of the time. The phrase Jack of all trades applies to many who have stewarded the development and recognition of the digital humanities as a discipline. Each of us has come to DH with a particular set of skills and interests, but too often we are expected to represent, if not to practice and teach, all of the methods and tools associated with the discipline. And if you follow me on Twitter, I believe that now is my avatar. It has been, it's become an in-joke among those of us who've been working on the DH conference for the last 2 years, that this need for a Batwoman superhero in Lego is very important. So herein lies one of our anxieties and one of the tensions congruent with the task of evangelizing to our colleagues, our institutions, our students, our grant funding agencies. I've observed and do believe that in order to engage fully in the digital humanities, one must be fluent in at least one discipline and one method, and perhaps be conversant in at least one more of each. That anxiety, and don't panic, you'll be fine. but that's how I feel. The anxiety is particularly acute for those of us who are tasked with developing and sustaining DH at an institutional level. Our overlords assume that we know how to code, encode, graph, plot, and even change the filament spool, I can't, at the same time that we are conversant in world literature, linguistics, cultural and environmental studies, geography, sociology, at least one of the Romance and one of the classical languages, the natural sciences, architecture, possibly engineering. I realize that's an extreme position, but it is one that many of us experience, or some of us at least, and I know I do, although I'll never get to the engineering part, sadly for the engineers at Bucknell. Or perhaps they laugh at me for not knowing what I'm talking about. As I said in the abstract, as humanists, we're trained to think across methods while we focus on a particular theoretical or practicable approach to our research. As digital humanists, we undertake that same type of training to find a digital method that best helps us ask questions of, analyze, and share our subject matter. Let's reframe this in order to look at how we can best prepare for the types of work that are ahead of us, work that can be accomplished through new approaches to collaboration. So first, let's change from the problematic phrase jack of all trades to the term polymath, a person of wide-ranging knowledge and learning, not omniscient, or I don't know what if one is on omniscience, has omniscience, which is just way too arrogant. I think polymath is something we can aspire to be. Would you believe that, though, when I Googled the word polymath, thinking that I would find a non-gendered representation, all I got were either pictures of old men with beards thinking deep thoughts, or women that were strangely clad and not what I would think of as being polymaths, or Stephen Fry. and I love Stephen Fry, but I just thought it was better to just put the word up there and try to avoid that. So Stephen Fry for the win, but, you know, polymath name be he. If you've attended one of the annual DH conferences, and there is still time to register for DH 2017 to be held August 8th through 11th in lovely Montreal, so please come, you will know that you are among hundreds of polymaths, also not in Athens and not just men. But it was fun to mess with a classical painting. Media studies scholars do network analysis. Classicists do GIS. Archaeologists do VR and 3D printing. And where would we be without medievalists who do TEI, I ask you, James? The knowing and the doing, the theory and the praxis, all are how we function. So here you are at the beginning of your week. Embrace your polymathic sensibilities, because all the cool kids in DH are doing it. It's true. None of us are cool, but we're all doing it. So What I'd like to do for a moment is talk about one of the things that James said that I talk a lot about, which is pedagogy and digital humanities pedagogy specifically. And first of all, and I would like to describe to you a course I teach, that I love to teach, that my colleague Katie Fall and I designed at Bucknell a few years back, which I think also helps to reinforce the ideas that I'm talking about today. I think we actually have a piece about this course in the first Doing DH volume, I think. I was trying to remember that last night, and I forgot to look it up. So the course that I teach is called Digging into the Digital, or Humanities 100. It's an intro-level DH course, but our intro undergraduate courses can be can be taken by a first year or a fourth year. That doesn't matter. It's in effect a methods course. I build the course on one set of archival materials, and this is why it's fun for me. To date, I've used the diaries of a captain in the American Civil War, which happens to be something that a corpus that Bucknell holds, so it's a found archive. I've used a collection of jests printed in 1600 about the clown actor Richard Tarleton, as well as in that same course, a corpus of 16th century performance records from records of early English drama. This fall, I'm going to teach a version of the course that involves a true crime in early 1920s Hollywood. So we're going to be using newspapers and to figure out who did it, because no one's ever solved the murder, and I figured if anyone's going to do it, it's a bunch of digital humanists. So the course is structured in modules, and each one is built upon the last. If I'm using manuscript materials, the students start by doing transcription, which is really interesting at a time when many of my students are no longer learning cursive. So I'm actually having to acquaint them with cursive at the same time that they're doing transcriptions. Then we clean the texts and do some text analysis. Then we learn some TEI and mark up the text diplomatically and semantically. Then we pull entities from the markup and experiment with social networks. And finally, we do some mapping. And this is all in about 14 weeks. The course works because each of the students owns a piece of the material we're working with. Even when we pull pieces of the text together to do larger scale analysis with corpus, each one of them is the recognized expert on that particular section. And oftentimes, they become better acquainted with it than I am. So it really is one of those things, if you hear about, you know, the idea of teaching naked, that, you know, when your students are telling you, no, that's not what happened in this section, it's a humbling but important moment. The course also works because it engages students with different types of aptitude and interest. I have students who so love transcription that they've asked me to create a transcription club on campus. Katie Fall, my colleague, had two students in one of her sections who described their approach to markup in their reflection essay as being carpet bombing markup. And they wanted to mark up everything. And it isn't often that you find yourself having to dissuade your students from doing more work. But if, as for those of you who are doing TEI this week, you'll realize that there is a reason to be judicious in what you choose to mark up. And you can't just mark up everything willy-nilly. The particular joy of the class for me is watching as they begin to understand what research looks like. So they're not just learning these methods, and they're not learning about a particular set of materials or subject that they might not engage in a more traditional course, but they actually are pursuing with me a form of research, right? They're not fully blown research assistants. I don't cross the line that many have discussed that's very important to think ethically about students doing research in the classroom as opposed to students doing research for pay. Labor issues are very important to think about. But I find that students actually want to come back and do more DH, whether or not they're compelled by the particular assignment matter, they actually want to do more markup, they want to do more transcription, they want to do more mapping. And then not only do they take more courses, but we engage them in independent study projects and independent research projects. We have a kind of a cool program at Bucknell where a student as a merit scholarship comes in and for 4 years does research with a particular faculty member or staff member. And I have a student who came up to me as a sophomore this year. She decided to change her project and wants to work with me on the records of early English drama and the map of early modern London. And in an environment where not too many undergraduates are really keen on 16th century drama and performance, I fell off my chair and said, of course you can work with me. All right, so as I'm teaching them all of these spiffy methods that we all need to learn, I also talk to them about different projects that are out there in the wild and why they should be thinking about the work they're doing and the methods they're engaging in and how we do that outside of the classroom and how their perspective actually is plays out in those projects. So I'm modeling for these students the experiences we have learning different methods that help us as we ask different questions of materials. And I'll gallop through these quickly, and I won't really spend any time explaining what they each are. But I go for the cool factor or the important factor, or this is why a project is transformative in terms of the humanities. So when I'm talking about preservation and why it's important to think about a corpus and archival materials, I talk a little bit about the Great Parchment Book and how it not only has been preserved, but also through that preservation has been transcribed and marked up and made available for analysis. Talk about Livingston Online, which is super cool, or was the cool kid. It's all about cool kids because they figured out how to. And you. Did you work on that? James worked on that. They used spectral imaging to reclaim a piece of David Livingston's diary that in the course of doing that reclamation actually helped them to rethink his role in events in Africa when he was there. I talked to them about the Women Writers Project and the Perseus Project and what it means to undertake something that is so massive and why the digital humanities can pull back into the discourse texts that might not necessarily have been recognized traditionally through print means because they don't meet the canon quota. So I also have them as we're doing this. They critique each of these projects to think about why they're strong and what is it about them that is compelling or important to both the PIs involved, the teams involved, and also to the audiences for them. We talk about textual editions. These are only two: the Walt Whitman Archive, Holinshed Project. What it means to think about texts and really dig down and find the text and context. I ask them to critique the project and what is its objective. So in one case, you're trying to figure out in the Whitman archive, if you've seen it, one of the things that's really interesting is that Whitman overwrote and rewrote poems like Leaves of Grass. And so you're actually able to follow through his own reinterpretations of his poetry through the markup that's done. And Holinshed, I just, I'm a fangirl for things chronicular, chronicles. We also talk about social networks a little bit, although truth be told, that is my Achilles heel. I love social networks and network analysis and visualization, but Gephi is the bane of my existence. We've talked about Mickey Kaufman's Quantifying Kissinger, which is actually a remarkable dissertation project and also it gives us incredible, as an American embarrassed at the current state of my country, she's giving a really helpful historical explanation of what's going on right now through the lens of Nixon and Kissinger. I talk about the new 6 Degrees of Francis Bacon, which is a really interesting way of it's cute in its title, but really powerful in the sense of being able to figure out who was associated with whom in early modern culture. Just as a side note, and speaking about gender, One of the things that's interesting, I was speaking to Scott Weingart about this project, and it's good that it's still in beta. Most of our projects are in perpetual beta, but what they realized as they were doing the visualizations and analyses of these social networks is that they were using the ODNB, I believe, as well as some other sources to try and you know, scrape the information about the people and how they were related to one another. And they realized after the fact that many, if you are going through the site and looking for women, oftentimes it's very difficult to find them because they are identified through their association with a man. So mother of Mrs. Jones, second Mrs. Jones. So what they realized they need to do is they actually need to go back through the corpus and reclaim and re-identify and represent many of the people who've appeared to be lost, but in fact are right there. They're just obliquely mentioned. And I think that's one of the things that I'm really interested in the project that James and I are going to be working on, is looking through this massive Records of Rural English Drama corpus collection. And I'll talk about that a little bit in a moment, and actually trying to figure out who's in there. Because a lot of times when you think about these huge collections of archival materials, it's only through the process of discovery that you realize that there are people that need to be identified that might not necessarily have been done so through to traditional means. okay, so I will switch quickly to my own research and research projects that I'm associated with. And I'm keeping an eye on the time so you can get to your classes. I forgot about databases, and maps. Maps are among my favorite things in the world. I went yesterday with James, and he wanted to show me the treasures and the Jane Austen manuscripts, and all I wanted to look at was the major map that you will see at drinks tonight. I love Christopher Saxton and Chef, what's the name of the
Selden.
Selden. Tapestry. But so I'm very interested, as James said, is at the intersection of mapping and text. So I will talk a little bit about that. And with that, I lost my place in my slides. Okay. So James, shut up, juggling. So one of the projects I've been associated with is the Internet Shakespeare Editions. As James mentioned, I'm the technical editor. I'm also editing the Henry VIII, or All Is True. As technical editor on the project, I'm working with Martin Holmes and Janelle Genstad and the team to transition the collection from an old hyper-customized form of SGML that's called Smiglish. If you know anything about SGML, you understand how customizable it is and how non-standardized it has become. And we're moving it all into TEI XML, which is a remarkable project because so many of the texts have already been done, and yet so many are still to be done. So we're negotiating how we work with different editors who are, to one degree or another, comfortable with markup editing, as well as scholarly editing. We're overhauling much of the content on the site, streamlining it, and finding better ways for the editors to interrogate and analyze their texts. And this is one thing I think that's really important. It's very easy for me to show you artifacts, right? We're very interested in artifacts and what they do, and when you click something, what does it reveal to you? But in fact, for me, and I think for many of my colleagues, really the importance of working in the digital is allowing us to engage in process. I do most of my text, my close reading analysis of the text that I'm creating, the Henry VIII edition, in TEI, because that helps me to make sense of what I'm looking at. It's a form of hyper-close reading. And most of the things that I'm marking up are never going to see the light of published day unless you download my TEI, because I'm using it for very specific editorial reasons. And I'm having to try and have that conversation with other editors who may or may not be comfortable thinking the same way. And I'm trying to encourage them not to have to think the same way, which is challenging, because I get very excited. I think I came to the project not because I'm some whiz-bang textual editor, in fact, I know I'm not, but because of my abilities in DH, which is kind of funny because they thought I knew a lot about TEI, and I've actually learned a lot of TEI in the trenches. So I, you know, what is it? Fake it till you make it is the phrase. So don't tell Janelle that I said that, please. Or Martin. Martin's more forgiving than Janelle. But for the purpose of this talk, I'd like to identify the project as one in which all of the participants have come from one disciplinary group, right? We're all Shakespeareans in one way or another. And we're all using one, we're all collaborating in one DH method. And I'd say it even more closely focused than that, because the editors are Shakespeareans with a capital S or H, a capital S. And we're now working expressly with TEI, so it's that transition has happened in our minds already, and we're using that one method to publish these digital scholarly editions or this group of editions. At some point down the road, we're going to integrate some text analysis tools and visualizations as well, but that is a way off, and I think really, truly, this project will only ever be an edition project that is rooted in markup. But the good news is that fortuitously and perhaps serendipitously, ISE is not a siloed project, and that's an important term you hear increasingly. We don't want these projects to live in silos. We want to find ways for them to work together and work more broadly. Siloed projects are in danger of almost from the beginning being made obsolete, so it's important to think about, as you are planning your own scholarly project, how can you make it sustainable and who else can you work with in order to continue the project. In this case, the ISE has sibling projects. PIP is associated with one of them, the Digital Renaissance Editions. There's also the Queensmen Editions and the Map of Early Modern London project. Through the digital affordances between ISE, DRE, and QME, we're looking for ways to make real granular connections among editions in the three collections, as well as with the map. Straightforward examples of this would be examining Henry VIII, for me, in conjunction with a proposed edition. I have to get to that one of these days. It's hard to find time. Of Samuel Rowley's When You See Me, You Know Me, which I believe is a kind of urtext for Henry VIII, and I think there's a real case to be made for reading them dialogically. There's another example might be Henry V and the Queen's Men edition of Famous Victories of Henry V, another proto-history play, as well as with Thomas Dekker's Shoemaker's Holiday, which was written in the same year as Henry V, and you can kind of see them as the war at home and the war abroad, right? So there's this really interesting political connection and cultural connection to make across those two plays that you really wouldn't be able to do with side-by-side print editions, right? I'm just geeking out on the early modern, so I'll get away from that in a moment. So DH projects can do that in a way that text projects can't, right? You can create a compendium or, you know, all of the Arden editions you want, but really when you can begin this kind of dialogic reading among projects, that's really different and really compelling and works for scholars and for students as well. The real synergy for me as someone who does text and place is the idea of incorporating the Map of Early Modern London project, of which Janelle is the director and lead investigator and actually came to ISE through MOEML, as it's called. We have all these strange acronyms. Because it creates a compelling intersection between the literary and the historical London through a richly annotated version of the 1561 Agus map, along with chronicle accounts such as Stowe's Annals, a gazetteer, a prosopography, my favorite word of 2017, prosopography, a listing of people and places and organizations that you can do in TEI. It's super fun. I'm like band girl, what can I say? So the lovely thing about MOEML is that it is predicated on the literary. So it's a map with a very particular focus of how you, or lens upon which you see a historical place. So for me, again, what this allows is that through my edition, I can make seamless connections which has been classified, strangely enough, as a city comedy, and to various locations and contextual information about them in Moemmel. So I can talk about the multiple identities of York Place and Whitehall and how its identity changed after Cardinal Wolsey fell and Anne Boleyn and Henry married. I can look at Blackfriars as a theater and a court. I can consider the journeys across the city of the Duke of Buckingham as he fell and went from Westminster to the Tower to be beheaded, and Anne Boleyn as she came from the Tower to Westminster to be married. So this strongly speaks to my interest in how you can dive into text and how you can look at them spatially and temporospatially. And the fascinating thing about this here is that we have an increasing number of participants, right? We have collaborators who are working across the three text editions, ISE, DRE, QME. We have people who are working in Moemmel, but it's still all, even though Moemmel is based on a mapping interface, it really is all text. What started as a map project, actually, if you look at it, the map has now only become this kind of veneer through which all of the data that you're looking at, all of the information that you're working with is textual. So it's this huge collaborative project, and it all feeds still through one method. Okay, so very quickly now, I want to talk about two projects that I'm working on or I'm associated with that talk to the broadest idea of how you think intermethodologically about DH and how we need to shift from positions of one to many methods as we switch from one to many disciplines. The first is Moravian Lives. It's a project that is the PIs of which are Katie Fall, my colleague, and Christer Ahlberger at the University of Gothenburg. The project is rooted in data of about 60,000 members of the Moravian Church from 1750 to 2000 around the world. For those of you who know about the Moravians or may not, it was a church that was very much, its members moved with remarkable rapidity from continent to continent. For some reasons to do mission work, but also because they seem to be a traveling group. So there are memoirs. These memoirs were written as part of their religious experiences as they were about to die. Katie's described it as kind of a farewell to their congregation, which together, these 60,000 memoirs make up a universal history of the church. So it's a really profound set of documents. And there are two formal archives with whom we've begun working, one being Herrnhut in Germany and the other being the archives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, but there are many more archives that are coming online as partners. There are also many more research partners coming on from universities in Germany and Australia and Sweden, more in Sweden and in Canada, I believe. The first phase of the project, which you see a very squidgy visualization of, is the initial representation of the metadata of the 60,000 memoirs that we have to date. And they list, you can actually search very simply by person name, birth or death date, or place, and you can follow their, you can learn more about their where that memoir is kept, so therein lies the metadata, and also the connections among places. You know, we have heat maps and links among places you can draw. You can find different, I think this is all of the women named Anna. I just was curious to see all the women named Anna. There's a woman named Anna Lichtman who Katie works particularly with, but I wanted to see what happened if I Googled Anna. The challenge, or not Googled, I searched. So we've got this meticulously recorded metadata, but we also have these 60,000 memoirs, many of which are in manuscript form. Not many have been printed and published, so they were shared by hand and transcribed after they'd been dictated. They're in German and English and Swedish and a number of different languages, and the forms of dictation are, you know, from 18th century German to 20th century English and everywhere in between. So we're trying to figure out right now, what do we do with the data in those memoirs? How do we get that transcribed? 60,000 documents, not easy to transcribe, as people who've done Transcribe Bentham have, can attest. So how do we create some sort of mechanism through which we can ask people to take part in the transcriptions and then mark them up? Apparently, the Moravian, because there's a strong genealogical component to an interest in the Moravians, there are a number of people out there who are interested in participating in such events. They want to find out where their uncle might be. There are also all of these yet-to-be-found archives in the Caribbean, and we know they're there, but nobody has actually gone to find them. And so we're trying to figure out how we can, right now, put together a team that will allow us to do all of these things. It's really, truly a puzzle box, right? We don't quite know where to start. And there are many places to start, but we need to have the right people in place to help us do that. Not only disciplinarily, because this corpus allows for people who are interested in religious history, people who are interested in translation, people who are interested in autobiography, but also, you know, how from the get-go do we think about text and image and visualization and mapping and time. So we want to do it right in order for people to make the most of it that they can, and that's key too. We're not just doing this for ourselves. We're trying to make it as openly available as possible. And so for the last bit, I'm going to riff about Read Online, which is so new that it doesn't even have its own page. So I used Read London. So I used Read Online's webpage as a placeholder. The Records of Early English Drama is a 40-year-old project that constitutes about 20,000 pages of printed, transcribed archival materials about performance and music in England, Scotland, Wales from 1100 to 1642. As of last fall, I convinced the board of Reed to let us focus on Reed in London, which actually is one of the last pieces that they wanted to focus on because they were more interested in the provinces, starting with York and continuing on. But now, and James and I are project team participants in a grant application that we're putting in tomorrow. Looking at the clock, tomorrow, day after tomorrow, that's another reason I keep getting the plague. I've been writing a grant proposal that's really daunting. But the idea, what we're trying to do is use this as an opportunity to pull together materials that have been published and printed about London performance, resources that have already been put online in different formats, and also plan for new types of projects that are going to be produced. And the importance, again, of creating this kind of multi-methodological collaboration among people is that it would be easy to think of it in just the terms of print. That's enough, right, to think about how this corpus should be represented print-wise. But we recognize that there's a huge opportunity to dive in and think about the named entities of all of these people, as I was saying with the Six Degrees Project, who are these people that are in this corpus of 500 years of records? And not just performers and aristocrats, but clerks and judges and tavern keepers and all of these people who were associated with performance in London. We think that what we can do is actually create a model that then can be amplified to ingest, which is a strange term, the rest of the legacy Reed print editions, but also find ways, because this remarkable collection is meticulously tracked bibliographically to archives throughout London and throughout England. So what I really want to do is find a way for people who don't care about early modern theater or performance. I know it's shocking that there are people out there who don't, but that here is a way forward for you who study political history or who are really interested in doing what I've jokingly called a forensic linguistic analysis of the English language over 500 years in London, how we can actually put those opportunities in place. And while it would be great to do that serendipitously and anticipate that somebody somewhere out there will figure out what they want to do with it, it's a mistake to assume that that might happen later, right? There are too many projects that have just said, well, someone will figure out what to do with it. And then we wait and nobody comes, right? It's like, well, of course they will find this out. So if we can front load, I guess, the types of collaborators who understand things from different disciplines, but also how we can begin to think from the beginning about, well, what does this mean, this data, if we put it into these named entities, pull them out and put them into social network analysis? What kind of visualizations would we need to develop to make that happen? What kind of mapping do we need to be thinking about? Because you all know that places don't continue to exist in the same footprint, right? And a reference to a tavern that existed 400 years ago on Gracechurch Street, it's not even that it isn't there anymore. We don't know exactly where it was. So to say constructive or with certainty that this is the pin in the Google map where the bull and bear existed is just patently untrue. So how do you think historically about mapping, right? That's a very different thing. So we're putting together this super cool team of people that are coming together across, like this team of 10 of us that are the core team for this grant are actually coming from different perspectives. We all have similar interests in the research material, but we're all thinking about it, and I'm tasking people with thinking about it in different ways, and purposely in different ways. And I think that's actually what the grant agencies are starting to look for. And so that was the big nod of, yes, I know, I'm out of time. So anyway, as our projects mature and become more connectable or linkable, as the promise of the interoperability, or as Martin Holmes prefers, interchangeability, moves along the continuum from nice idea to something that is actually possible through this type of intentional, intensive, intermethodological collaboration, we have to begin to recognize the value not only of the polymath, which I've kind of obliquely been describing throughout, who has to have more general extensive knowledge of many of these methods and subjects, but also the crucial integration of those who are masters of one subject or one method as part of that larger collaboratory, that we go from a centralized hierarchical project structure to one that is more horizontally structured, where the interlinking happens not after the fact, as it did in the case of ISC and MOEML, and all but at the project's inception, such as these projects that are just coming online, and frankly, still, thank you.